Thank you very much, Vanessa. Before we start, my name is Louise Fryer, F-R-Y-E-R. I'm a non-blind white British woman with grey blue eyes and short brown hair that's even more in need of a cut than when I described myself earlier in these conferences. I'm in my late 50s and I'm wearing a black and white stripy top. I would also like to mention that I have impaired mobility. Not that that's very obvious on Zoom, but some people might notice I only gesture with my right hand. As Vanessa said, we have just two speakers on this panel. I'm delighted to say that they're both early career researchers. And we're going to hear first from Marion Ang, spelled I-N-K. I hope that's how you pronounce it, Marion. Marion is broadly interested in perception, not, I think, of the individual, but of the group. She's interested in how people live together and develop social bonds, and what a visual or auditory impairment, to fall back on the medical model, can tell us about ordinary categories of perception on the one hand, and on the other, about the organisation of scientific work and social and professional relationships. Marin approaches her observations through the prism of her visual disability. For the past year, she's been based at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. Marion, you have 5 minutes. So I shall hand over to you.
Merci beaucoup. Est-ce que vous m'entendez bien?
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Good. Thank you very much, and thank you for this presentation and for all of the organization of this conference, which is really well organized and really very pleasant because everything is going very smoothly. And I hope that will be an example for other conferences to pay attention to all these details. So thank you. So yes, I'm Marion Ink. To describe myself, I'm a white woman. I have brown hair and brown eyes. I'm wearing a black headset and a flowery top. And you won't be able to see my background because I've blurred it with my camera. I'm non-sighted. I have a pathology on my retina, which was discovered when I was 10, and it's progressed, and so it obstructs my central vision, but that keeps my peripheral vision. So what I have to say about perception, first of all, began from a methodological point of view to begin with. I wrote my thesis on sociabilities and micropolitics of social abilities in sociology. And to do this, I participated observations in 3 universities in France, the US, and Canada. And throughout my thesis and when I was defending my thesis, a number of researchers who supervised my thesis and published my work asked a lot of questions about my competency without calling into question much as how I could observe things, how to do ethnographic observation when I was visually impaired. And so I wrote a first article entitled Observing the Proofs of a Visual Deficiency in Spaces and Society in 2016. And so this examined methods and perceptions. And then in 2019, I had a doctoral position. And then as a researcher at the INSERM, I worked on researchers, or worked with researchers with visual and or auditory handicaps to see how their experiences could give us a better idea, firstly, of perception-related questions, ordinary perception, and the organization of scientific work of institutions and with social and socio-professional relationships. And in the end, disability was an analytical resource for me to study processes and practices and phenomena relating to people with disabilities and also people who didn't have disabilities, non-blind people or non-deaf people, etc. And for this conference, I offered a chapter of a book that will be published in the near future, but it's already been validated. This is the final version, called A Practical Approach to Perception, which looks at the experience of people with visual and or hearing disabilities and different categories of perception. And I show how it's important to go beyond sensory understanding of perception. Firstly, because this makes non-seeing makes them static, and they're defined in terms of not being able to see, and the same thing for hearing impaired or deaf people. It's always with respect to good hearing. And when we look at this, we can understand that the perception is a process. It's the result of a learning experience throughout our life, and that's the case for everybody. It's social, it's collective, it can be shared, and that's the case for everybody. However, the experiences of a visual and hearing disabilities enables us to highlight things that are found in everybody, that everybody perceives. And so I show this as well in this chapter and in other things that I've written, and begin to work with somebody working in neurosciences who's working on this issue of perception of non-sighted people birth, where feet and all the zones of the brain are used, contrary to what I believe. It's just the way that the visual information is processed goes through other zones that are activated by auditory information. So there's not a lack of information. For example, visual information, it goes straight to the interpretation. And so what I suggest is to come back, bring back to an advanced understanding what is sensitive and social and socialization of perception, and to understand that it's not just a matter of seeing things, but of how we interpret what we see, and we can't distinguish the actual pure information, a noise that you hear, and our brain immediately interprets it, and that can lead to fear or other emotions, for example. So that is an understanding that I suggest for perception, which seems to be much more accurate or obvious when we look at the experiences of people who have a visual or auditory disability. There are a lot of presentations at this conference that have allowed us to see that, and that is really a summary of what I have to say.
Thank you very much, Marianne. I think it's really fascinating, the idea that perception is about interpretation, and we're being given a splendid example of interpretation at this conference. So your speaking is, I heard it in English, which is not your words, but it's an interpretation of your words, and other people are experiencing it through various types of sign language, So there's loads and loads of layers of interpretation. So I think it's kind of, for me, it's a huge step forward to think of perception as interpretation. It makes lots of sense to me. And in my role as an audio describer, I'm constantly trying to say to people, it will be an interpretation. I can't give you an objective view of what's happening because it's filtered by my sight, which is filtered by my brain, which is filtered by my own experience. So I think there are lots and lots of fascinating overlaps with talk about blind culture. Anyway, thank you for that. I'm going to move on to our second speaker, Soline Venetier, who's based at the same School of High Studies of Social Sciences in Paris, but in the history department, which is the discipline of her PhD, when she studied the history of cochlear implantation. And her fascination is with the contemporary history of deaf blindness and deafblind people in France, the US, and in various transnational spaces. Soline is going to share her reflections on contemporary historical research on deaf blindness and deaf-blind people. Soline, 5 minutes for you.
So, greetings everybody. My name is Soline Venetier. I'm delighted to be part of this conference, which is very important and stimulating. And like Marion, I'm very appreciative of this particular format. I'm speaking to you from Toulouse in the south of France. And so I'm in a black top, I have short hair, and behind me I have a black background, just as you see with the sign language interpreters, because I have a folding screen which I use when I'm video conferencing, particularly when I'm talking with hearing impaired people who rely on sign language, because since I'm light-skinned, this gives better perception of gestures. And in this round table, I'll be using French, spoken French. And another aspect that perhaps you can neither see nor hear is that I'm deaf and blind. So I am in the fourth year of thesis at the Higher Institute of Social Studies. My initial research was in the study of deaf people and sign language, which means that, well, recently I changed track slightly in terms of my research objectives, which is why I'm here today. I was not considering talking about it here, but Marion talked about how she came to study blindness, so perhaps I should say something about that, my own decision. I worked on the history of cochlear implants, comparing France and Swedish practices in France and Sweden, but for various reasons, which is because I'm becoming increasingly deaf and blind and therefore need to understand how to perform research and how to do data gathering and source analysis in differing or changing ways. It's becoming more and more difficult for me to undertake this research, and the timing of this learning experience was not necessarily compatible with doing a PhD research, because that is a limited time. And in addition, during my research, I became interested in deafblind individuals, and therefore I decided to change the recording in progress of my thesis. The history of deafblindness and deafblind individuals has been little studied, apart from the iconic figures, in particular Laura Bridgman, these figures from So BRIDGMAN, Marie-Hertin, HEURTIN. And Helen Keller, figures with regard to the education of deafblind people. But apart from these iconic figures, there is very little research on deafblind individuals in general. And my research began in the 1960s, because from that point, I thought that there was a transnational community of deafblind people, a scientific space and partly a political space with experts, educators, activists, looking at the definition of deafblindness and varying definitions that could be applied, and coordinated attempts to have solutions catering for such individuals, whether it be specialist institutions, administrative recognition, or non-profit forums. And I'm in particular interested in the social dimension of this world, and also the measures, practices, and representations that stakeholders have, and the way that these stakeholders organize and take action together. In terms of methodology, I'm working both on the basis of written sources, non-profit archives, administrative documents, and I also work on semi-directive interviews with the people who write the history of deafblindness. I think that my 5 minutes is pretty much up, so I'll stop there so we can start having a conversation together.
Thank you very much, Celine. So again, there's a fascinating thread running through both the presentations about data collection, about being a researcher with so-called impairments, but also how those so-called impairments can actually be so revelatory in terms of data research, and how by studying different cultures, so in Celine's case, Sweden and France, you're learning different ways that people have approached disability and finding different solutions for making their data accessible. So it seems to me that you two were made for each other in terms of research. Yesterday, there was a feeling that blindness is a culture. I wonder what your thoughts are on this. Can I start with Marion?
I've been thinking about this throughout our time at this conference, and my concern is that researchers' experience in France and the US who have a perceptible difficulties is a source of research and investigation, but that is not really my research topic. I'm looking more about how their scientific work is organized, so it's a little bit difficult for me to talk about the issue of culture as such. Is there a deaf culture, a deafblind culture? Other colleagues work on that topic, but I'm not sure that I'm qualified or able to talk in terms of, I find it difficult to talk in terms of blind culture, in fact.
Celine, do you have an opinion about whether or not there is such a thing as blind culture? I feel that deaf culture is very strongly established, blind culture less so, but I'm open to persuasion otherwise.
I think there's a number of ways of answering this question. and I'll try and structure my answer. Deaf studies, or whatever it's called in whichever language, are based on the assumption of the existence of a deaf culture because there is a shared language, sign language, even if this is a national sign language rather than international. And of shared cultural identity by the members of this linguistic community. Whereas in deaf studies, there is some discussion about whether there is any uniqueness in deafness compared to other so-called categories of handicap, disability, whether it's field of vision impairment or whatever. So that is the response from a deaf studies perspective. Personally, like Marion, I find it difficult to take a position on blind culture because it's not really my research topic, but I could say a few words about deaf-blind culture, or deaf-blind cultures more accurately. And I think that they're probably quite similar to blind cultures, in the plural again. In other words, many different ways of self-perception of deaf and deaf-blind individuals and blind individuals, and in deaf-blind individuals, the way they perceive themselves as a group may be different, and sometimes they may be conflicting. Some deaf-blind people will adopt the medical model, others are in take a more critical stance with respect to the medical model. And another thing which it's important to bear in mind when we're looking at deafblind culture is the existence in the US of the pro-tactile movement. I don't know if some of you in this symposium may know about this movement, which emerged in Seattle in the 2000s in a deaf-blind group, who met in a service center for the deafblind community, who developed this language pro-tactile, which is accompanied by specific culture and lifestyle, and there's definitely an asserted specific culture which has not been defined by some academic, but is definitely proactively asserted by the members of this community. And those in the pro-tactile movement are from have the deaf blindness because of a specific syndrome, and emerged out of their experience in this community in the United States, which grew out of Usher syndrome, those suffering from Usher syndrome. As I was listening to Soline, I remembered something which I don't think I meant or I've heard to date in this symposium, or maybe I stepped out of the room and I missed it, but
something
which is common to virtually all disabilities, but it's manifested in very different ways. creep time. So, crip, C-R-I-P, sorry, crip time. This has been borrowed from an activist movement in the US. Initially with people with motor handicaps to define their specific relationship with time, which is specific to the disabled individuals. So, for example, aging, faster aging of the body and relationship with early childhood.
Que j'interroge, donc, qui sont concernés par,
and people I interview who have visual or auditory deterioration, this is much more subtle. People tend to say something like, I'm working on a just-in-time basis, I need to anticipate, but I feel like I'm working on a just-in-time basis all the time. And this is a bit like another element of crip time, which is this different relationship to time, because all activities will take more time. Speech to text will be, I mean, have a different relationship with time compared with somebody who simply reads straight off, or text to speech, sorry, yeah, takes more time. There's the implication of interpreters at a talk. If the talk does not have its own, if the conference doesn't have its own interpreters, they need to go find some. Visually handicapped researchers will need to, other individuals who are visually handicapped will need to be able to organize travel with somebody with them, read correspondence, adapt their time schedule to the person who is assisting them. In other words, fit in with others' availabilities. In other words, to others' time, adapting to our own time frames. There's also fatigability. In other words, how quickly we tire is a shared concern, specific to each individual, but of course a common factor in many forms of disability. And this concept has been particularly studied for motor handicap individuals, but much less focused on those with other types of disability. In any case, what I'm trying to bring out is this relationship with time, which is a cultural feature of, I think, all forms of disability, individuals with disabilities that I have interviewed.
Thank you very much for that point. I think earlier in the week, or earlier in the start of the conference, Vanessa was talking about time and our different relationships to time. And you mentioned, Celine, that data gathering took more time for you. I wonder how, if any other methodologies have been influenced by time.
Je vais répondre à cette question et je voulais aussi rebondir.
Yeah, I'll answer, and I want to also come back to what Marion has just said, so two points to my answer. So firstly, this issue of time and how it fits in with methodology, very practically speaking in research, if there was intensive sorting through hard copy periodicals, I don't have a research assistant, never have had, so I had to do all this visually. So I had to travel to archives. So a new venue, and of course that has loads of issues about finding your way around and so on. And then also photocopying all the documents I wanted to work on, and then process them digitally on a computer, and with hundreds and hundreds of JPEG files. And because I have a very small visual field of vision, and I cannot simply scan a page visually as I could previously. So I either had to take more time, but I didn't know how much time I would have exactly, or I would have had to enlist the help of a research assistant with lots of questions about how that could happen, which would have been quite difficult for me, which would have meant changing my research topic, taking this difficulty into account, which is not really related to my access to the sources, but more issues of time. So in absolute terms, it could have been done, but institutionally in France, a thesis should happen in 3 years, generally more like 5 or 6, but that's a maximum. Which meant that I spent more time than in my first thesis topic looking at how I was going to deal with my sources and data. And in contemporary history of deaf blindness and work in the field of blindness where I'm working, quite a lot of resources are already digitized and can be exploited with text-to-speech software, which you can do from a PDF, which you can't do from a JPG file. So you can then search using keywords. I still have some hard copy archive documents to deal with, but far fewer than previously. And then there's also the issue of research interviews, but that doesn't necessarily take up more time than it would for somebody without so-called deficiencies. And I just wanted to haven't forgotten Marion. I wanted to say something about what she was saying about CryptTime. With respect to deaf blindness, I was thinking of a paper by a linguistic anthropologist, Sarah Edwards, E-D-W-A-R-D-S, giving up on the politeness, and she talks about sociabilization practices and politeness in a deaf-blind group at a restaurant, which shows the change in social norms compared to traditional able-bodied individuals. So touching one another, moving the tables, moving around during the meal, which are perceived as very impolite by other patrons of the restaurant, but are deemed to be a vital norm by this community. And the relationship with prevailing social norms in terms of what is considered polite can possibly be the indicator of a specific culture.
Thank you, Zolien. I'm wondering, listening to you, whether or not there's a role for broadening the way in which we record our records of historical data. I mean, they don't have to be written. Now there's so much access to other types of audiovisual information. What would you think would be more accessible generally than having to trawl through written data, which seems to me so limited?
If I've understood the question, it's how can we have access to historical audiovisual historical information?
I think really I'm trying to say that for so long, academia has been based on the written word. And maybe it's time to broaden those, that type of data into being the spoken word or the filmed response. I mean, are there better ways of recording data to make it more accessible?
So could I answer Solina? Thank you. What I find to be really interesting in what Solina's just said is that, of course, accessibility to documents, paper documents, so digitizing them to make them accessible in different ways is important and necessary. But the main difficulties are not really so much accessibility. It is accessibility, but it's also in particular the time required in higher education and research, and to have to respond to urgent deadlines. It's really difficult and causes a certain number of non-blind and non-deaf and researchers without disabilities to be overworked. When I speak to researchers, I find that people either give up their scientific career, or I think about researchers who are in panel of researchers to be questioned, to ask them why they gave up or why they persevere. They have managed to get a position and then they make choices. And so, for example, they can't do as much work in the field and publish at the same time and teach and go to conferences and at the same time apply for different funding, etc. So the question is, what am I going to do? And they focus their attention on tasks which often they enjoy the most, they're the most important ones for them. And then there's the problem of career changes, and they can get research positions. As far as I know, there have been very few researchers that have been promoted to research director. That some of them have been research directors, and then they've acquired a disability, but that often they're blocked because of time considerations, which are seen in the access to data, conferences, classes, etc. But that's exactly the article that I'm writing at the moment. Are researchers with disabilities blocked in their scientific work? And there are time considerations that affect all researchers. The density, the competitiveness is problematic for everybody, but it makes the situation, as Solina says, with accessibility we can manage, and which can be seen for example, with touch language, touch sign language, or somebody will read them, or with voice synthesis. You can find solutions which can sometimes take time to put into place. But then arises the question of the time considerations in higher education and research, which makes the slow science difficult.
Thank you. I'm interested, Marion, that you chose to base your research in the social sciences, and I'm wondering what the techniques and methodologies in the social sciences, how do they benefit your research?
Je suis pas sûre d'avoir compris la question.
I'm not really sure that I've fully understood the question.
Let me try to rephrase it. I'm interested in what you think are the methodologies within the social sciences that make your research well placed there, so that you chose to study in the social sciences rather than historical research or another area?
So
my work is in sociology, so social sciences. However, I'm not sure that I understand what you're really getting at. The researchers that I'm studying are all science, work in all the different sciences. They're astrophysicists, biologists, chemists. And for the question of social sciences, I think that it was the reflective approach of social sciences that led me to get into social sciences with a collaboration, of course, with what we call hard sciences.
Thank you. And Celine, what does bring a historical perspective add to your research?
The historical perspective, what it brings to my research, I would say, a better understanding of what's present in the field of blindness for people who are blind, because my research arose from what I observed in recent years in people involved in blind associations in France, and the practices that I observed, what people said, how people define deaf blindness, and that's very varied even amongst these associations, and the methods of organisation are very different. And I wondered where these current practices came from and where we'd inherited them from. And that's why I set out on this research journey, this historical research journey. I think that what I could answer today is that it's a better understanding of the present day, and maybe to light that shed on tools and organisational methods. And that's also why I'm involved in the field of disability studies, which is a part of my intellectual formation. And that's paying attention to the impact of research for the people concerned, who are, so what research can bring to them, can provide them with.
Thank you. Well, that brings us very neatly to the key questions of the symposium. So I'm going to put to our presenters in turn, Marion, starting with you, what definitions of blindness does your research and lived experience lead you to adopt?
A lot depends on the context and the situation. When I talk about this, I like to talk about perceptive alteration or alterity, to get away from the sensory dimension, to get away from the idea of visual or auditory deficit and all that that implies when we talk about deficiency. When I talk with the people concerned, I use their verbatims, and when it comes to perception, I usually talk about an alteration of perception, because I realize that people have a full perception, but which is completely different. Everybody has a specific perception, a very specific perception, but a full perception when I talk about the relationship of an organization or the organization of work or whatever. I usually will talk about the question of disability to avoid minimizing things, because if I just talk about a perception, that could minimize situations of discrimination, inequality, inaccessibility, etc. So even if I not really at ease with that, I will use the administrative category for reasons of recognition, for adjusting a workstation, for example. But I think there's something that happened that was said yesterday where there was the distinction was made between, I think it was Heidi Lawrence, who we were listening to yesterday afternoon. So when it's just the relationship with yourself, I talk about an alteration of perception. But when there's a discrimination or inequalities, there I would talk about visual disability.
That's a really fascinating idea, that it's relative depending on the situation, who you're having a conversation with. So, Lean, how would you define blindness, especially when you add deafness into the mix?
I have an answer and a positioning that's quite close, sort of Marion. I hesitate between the two. It's not really clear cut. But as a researcher and a person who's concerned with this, I'm interested in a plurality of definitions of blindness and deafblindness. There's not just a single one. And these definitions are part of a list that people can draw from, depending whether they're blind people, people with a slight defect or with X or Y syndrome. And depending on the situation, who you're talking to, for example, you could mention the legal definition of deafblindness, which isn't the same as the medical definition of deafblindness, at least in France. And it's not the same either as the different identity definitions are given by people themselves. And so in my research, I would like to just pause and say something else, that in my research, I've taken a new direction recently, some at the beginning, so I haven't yet got to any hypotheses, but I'm interested in these different definitions and how they are changing and how they reflect each other or bounce off each other, and to define the subject of my research for deafblind people as a group. I don't have a single definition. I'm not just going to look at the history of people who have a serious sight deficiency or hearing deficiency. I'm not just going to look at people who recognize themselves as being deafblind or their own definitions. But what I wanted to get, the example I wanted to give of the importance of taking into account the plurality of definitions, and I was thinking of some research that I contributed to as a person concerned, where I was also living with the tools I had as a young researcher, and I'm looking to see, I think there's a problem maybe with the interpretation, but this is research that's important for deaf blindness in France, and this is sociological research on Usher syndrome, and people who are consumed by this syndrome were conducted in a broader set of research with a medical strand, we're looking at genetics too, etc. And this research, sociological research, showed the definition that maybe deaf, blind people, that other people with Usher syndrome, during this research, we saw that they had a tendency to reject any medical definition of deafblindness. They weren't interested in that. But on the other hand, this medical definition is really important to have access to administrative help, such as compensation, care, and recognition of the disability of deafblindness. And these things could be a key factor for autonomy and social participation. And so this research group started thinking about the medical definition of deafblindness and got these definitions to change, both from a medical and administrative point of view. I don't know whether you want me to talk about that a bit more, but I just wanted to talk about this research, which is important when you think about what the definition of blindness, of deafblindness is. And that shows the importance of taking into account the different definitions. And to encompass them all in our analysis. And there's another thing that I wanted to suggest. When if you take a step back and think about definitions of blindness and deafblindness, I wonder if we couldn't think in terms of the relationship with the norm, which so the experience of blindness or the representations you can have of that, or of deafblindness, call on a different relationship with norms or society norms of and the audiovisual capabilities of an inverted commas normal person, and that people who work in a certain way using their sight and their hearing. And deafblindness or blindness could come when there's a moving away from these norms.
Thank you. I think it's really very interesting that sighted people, non-blind people, are blind in many ways, and we just choose to ignore it. So there are lots of wavelengths of light that we can't see. We can't see gamma rays, can't see infrared. Personally, I have a certain kind of cultural blindness that I'm aware of in lots of areas. So I might see an African tribal cloth and I might be able to appreciate its pattern and its colour, but I wouldn't understand its cultural significance. I'd be blind to that because of my particular experience. So I think the concept of definitions of blindness being very tailored to different situations is very true. And I think the fallacy of the medical model is that they believe it explains blindness. And I think it's so limiting. That makes me very frustrated. I think perhaps because my own studies were in psychology, and you couldn't get a paper published at all unless you categorized the blindness using the medical model of all your participants. And I really reacted against that and tried to explain that everybody has a different type and is not categorizable in that neat, pigeonholy kind of way. So I'm interested too in whether you believe that critical blindness studies should be a separate room in the House of Disability Studies. Is there an advantage in studying blindness on its own? I mean, it seems to me, Celine, that you can't possibly want to study blindness on its own because of the influence of deafness and how that might change, but perhaps I'm putting words in your mouth. So in the last 5 minutes, before we go over to questions, I would be interested to know your response to that, as to whether or not critical blindness studies has a role to play within disability studies. Should it be on its own, or should it be part of disability studies more generally?
Marion,
maybe I'll let you start by answering that first. Yeah. Oh, well, okay, I'll go first and then you can follow on. Fair enough. So Soline says, I will not come down on one side or the other of this question. I think this field extends to anybody who wishes to include themselves within it, perhaps is how I would put things. And perhaps we shouldn't put this question as a binary alternative, either or. But I think there could be times and places where there will be closer dialogue between those working in more specific areas and other times when there could be broader dialogue between researchers working in apparently distant fields. And we could adjust the focal length, as it were, in different ways. To tie in with my own trajectory through deaf studies, there is a discussion going on about the place of deaf studies and how they relate to disability studies. I've never perceived the two fields. I know some colleagues disagree, but my personal view is that there is no clear difference between the two, and fundamentally I think they have the same broad paradigms, but that some aspects will be more emphasized by researchers in deaf studies and others by those working in disability studies. But in any case, it is important to take all of these aspects into account and not build watertight barriers between these fields. Well, I basically agree with what Soline has just said. It is important, and this symposium is the demonstration of the fact that we need to have 4 days of discussion to update or have updates on all the research that is going on. This is very enriching because it allows us to see how another discipline approaches these issues. So there is a cross-disciplinary aspect. In my case, my practical sensory approach following this symposium will have new arguments, new things to think about in my work on perception. Just as Soline has said, though, it is also important to work in a cross-disciplinary fashion. Often, when we, in terms of nationalities, African studies tend to be separated often. Well, only work on issues relating to Africa, whereas their research could be very, very informative for people who are working in completely different areas, in the same way as for us, issues that will emerge and lines of thinking that will emerge from this symposium and the conversations about blindness are actually key for other areas as well. And I'm interested in the sociology of science, and all of these issues would be of interest to this field, which have absolutely no concept of disability or blindness in particular, which is why it is very important to have these times when we are gathered in our particular discipline, but other times where we bring our questions to apply and look at how they apply to a completely different field of research, because this process will throw up things which are of interest to every discipline.
Thank you. I think that's a great perspective, and I'm really encouraged by the intelligence and enthusiasm and directions of our young researchers. I feel that critical blindness studies, whether or not they sit within disability studies or alongside, have a fantastic future ahead. And I can see now that there are some hands raised and people have questions to ask. So I'm going to hand back to our moderator. And I'm hoping that Vanessa is still here.
I am here, Louise.
Okay.
Everybody.
Back to you.
Thank you, Louise. Everybody, this is Vanessa Warren speaking. And I would like to begin by acknowledging Louise Fryer for her wonderful work as chair, and to thank Soline and Marion for a wonderful conversation as we transition now to questions. I will also take this opportunity to thank very much our translators and interpreters for the support they are providing to our conversation. We have three people waiting to speak, and I will acknowledge you in order. We will begin with a question from Bruno Lison, then Mr. Bertrand Verrien, we will turn to you, and lastly, we will turn to Zina Weygand. And I do have a question, if there is time, but we will start with Bruno, please. If you would like to unmute and ask your question, please go ahead.
Bonjour, merci pour...
Greetings, thank you for this excellent panel debate. My question is a very pressing current one. What is the impact of COVID-19 and health measures on the deaf community, and have you already done anything in terms of deaf studies in that respect? Soline is suggesting she answers.
Please, Soline, go ahead. Yes.
Il y a évidemment eu beaucoup d'impact.
Of course, there has been a considerable impact of health measures and the pandemic on the deaf community. And all those people who identify with the deaf community I couldn't summarize all of them, but impacts include access to emergency services and health services, communication with hospital staff. If a deaf person is hospitalized and cannot communicate with the medical staff, this can lead to great difficulties. Access to preventive messages, social distancing, and in particular, face mask wearing, is very difficult in terms of communication because the face mask means that you cannot lip read. Alternative face masks were suggested, but they weren't very effective either. In France, in any case, sign language interpreters were on the front foot during the pandemic. So very, very often there was sign language interpreting, in particular for government messaging, which helps alleviate the impact in that respect. I think there was a second question, but I'm afraid I can't remember what it was. Yeah. Has Deaf Studies already looked at this issue? I think that there's been some informal discussion and consideration, in particular about in the form of blog posts, a couple of research papers, ACRDEAFEIC, sorry, Academic, is an English language blog and an international sign language, which has a paper on that, I believe.
Thank you, Bruno, for the question. Marion, would you like to speak to the question of the pandemic before I turn to Bertrand?
No, I have nothing to add in particular.
Thank you. I will say that Bruno took my question. He stole my question. But I was specifically interested in the impact on your work as researchers. As many of you will know, Hannah, Marion Chotin and I hoped to gather us all in person. And I am very interested in what the movement to distanced or online engagement has meant for community, for access to resources, for your research process. But I will turn now to Bertrand Verin and ask him to kindly make his comment or share his question.
Merci, vous m'entendez?
Thank you. I hope you can hear me.
We hear you.
Yeah, loud and clear. So I firstly want to congratulate the two speakers because yesterday evening we finished on a rather difficult moment emotionally, and this afternoon it's a real delight to be here, and that is very promising in terms of the future of research. I have two questions, but also a comment which I believe has not come out enough yet. The significance and benefit of Marion's concept, sensory practices, because this is a way of breaking down barriers between disciplines and also between methods. Breaking down barriers just for no good reason can in fact drown the issues out. But if we can make cautious generalizations and avoid stereotyping and naturalism and showing due respect for the plurality and relatedness of situations. And this brings me to my two questions, and I'll put them both at the same time and then up to you how you address them. two key words. The first question. So, the first key word is holy sensorial, various. And the second I'll come back to is interculturality. So the first is holy sensory experience. This is an approach which has been developed in cognitive psychology, and more especially in a rather different field to ours, which is sensory analysis of products. So people, for example, marketing, advertising, design, and so forth, tasting sessions that clearly demonstrate, and their research shows this, that all individuals, whether or not they are aware of it, whether they believe they are visual or 99% visual, actually have a wholly sensory perception, a holistic perception of situations which involve other types of perception other than visual. And so I wanted to know whether you've encountered that, and whether you use, either of you use this concept of holy sensory experience, which I believe is important in our situations, because we, without a dominant sense, we have to make use of the dominated senses. And the other question is to do with interculturality. You've clearly brought out, following, as have other speakers, the importance of historic construction and historical conscience or awareness. But if I had one thing to add, is that we've had tiny windows of interculturality, but I think that finding the right, if we could find the right speakers, interculturality could make a major contribution to this conversation. I, quite by accident, I came across a paper that Soline might know, otherwise I'll let her know. About deafblind children in Uganda, which shows that their sensory learning experience is very different from that of Western deafblind children, because relations between adults and children, and particularly between mothers and children, are very different in Ugandan culture to those in Western culture. So I hope I haven't been too long. I'm so interested to hear what you have to say about those two topics.
Thank you, Bertrand. This is Vanessa again. I will just note we have one more question waiting and only 5 minutes left. So I will ask our speakers to be, if they can, brief. Marion, could we start with you, please?
Merci beaucoup, Bertrand, pour ces questions. Et merci de confirmer que l'hypothèse du practico-sensible vous parle. Alors, toutes les questions sur l'olisensorialité, et je vais mettre aussi la polysensorialité dans le lot, me posent en fait le souci. Ça va ? Il y a un enfant. Me pose le souci de rester sur des questions de sensorialité et sur et en fait d'effacer la question du sensible, mais elles reviennent dans l'interprétation en fait du mot de alors, je suis désolée, il y a mon bébé de 5 mois qui joue avec les oiseaux et donc qui crie un peu, mais tout va bien. Du coup, j'ai perdu ce que je voulais dire. Oui, sur l'approche polysensorielle, qui est effectivement, en fait, toute personne, dès lors qu'elle perçoit quelque chose, d'une part, perçoit avec...
Perceive things with their entire body, their houses, with their entire body. All of this is seen in things being sensitive, intuition and inner events, etc. And then we need to take a step towards being polysense, having a polysensory approach, but to my mind, that doesn't go far enough. But I can't really say more because we need to leave some time for the last question.
Thank you, Marion. To you, Céline.
Je n'avais pas croisé.
So I haven't yet come across the concept of holy. Sensory experience or polysensory experience, but I think that these are interesting. And like Marion, I'm thinking in particular about the issue of fields of research and access to and it's impossible to look to move on to processes of access to not just remain on sensory experience. But I'm answering very briefly, but yes, it makes me think a lot on the question of intercultural experience. I would like to read this article that you talked about, and thank you very much. And I would also like to read this article.
Thank you to Marion and Céline for those excellent answers. We have just 3 minutes left, and I would like to turn now to our final member of the audience with a question, and that is Zina Weygand. Zina, if you would like to go ahead. Sadly, Zina, it is Vanessa again. We cannot hear you. We apologize. Perhaps we will be able to pass your question on in a moment. So, unfortunately, given we have a technical difficulty with Zina's computer, I will instead close the session as we are almost at time. And I will thank again very much our wonderful speakers. I will thank Louise Fryer for her excellent work as chairwoman. And I will again thank our translators and interpreters for their much appreciated support. We look forward to joining you all again in 15 minutes. We have now a rest break. Thank you very much.